Over the last four episodes, we've been unpacking Lee Harvey Oswald's time in New Orleans and the characters who allegedly surrounded him. We looked at the intelligence-connected coffee company where Oswald worked and the ease with which Oswald obtained a passport, even though there should have been a State Department lookout card in place to stop him. We also did a deep dive on 544 Camp Street and Oswald's arrest and subsequent radio and TV publicity tour, where he promoted the views of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. In this episode, we turn our attention to two rural Louisiana towns north of Baton Rouge, Clinton and Jackson. Is it true that Lee Harvey Oswald visited these towns in the summer of 1963? If so, what was he doing? And was Oswald accompanied by David Ferry and Clay Shaw?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
I don't know what this is all about.
Dallas police this morning resumed custody. The man they have formally charged with the assassination of President Kennedy.
I'm just a patsy.
The man is Lee Oswald.
Was Oswald acting alone, or was he a member of a conspiracy? Commission answers, he acted alone.
This is Solving JFK. I'm your host, Matt Crumpton.
Before we dive into the Clinton-Jackson story, let's talk about why it matters. Lee Harvey Oswald is supposed to be a lone nut, according to the Warren Report, whose defenders maintain that Oswald had no relationship whatsoever with Guy Bannister, David Ferry, or Clay Shaw. So if Oswald is hanging out with Clay Shaw and David Ferry, as Warren Report critics allege happened in Jackson and Clinton, that evidence bolsters the idea that Oswald is potentially some sort of operative. Oswald hanging out with Ferry and Shaw would also undermine the idea that Oswald acted to kill President Kennedy on his own, if at all. But like anything else that matters in the JFK assassination, this story is intensely disputed territory. In late August of 1963, on a Wednesday afternoon, an unknown white male walked into a barbershop in rural Jackson, Louisiana. Edwin Lee McGehee, the barber, rarely cut the hair of strangers, so he remembered this man. During the 15 minutes that McGehee cut the man's hair, the stranger asked him if there were any jobs available because, quote, he really needed a job. Specifically, the man asked if McGehee knew whether they were hiring at the East Louisiana State Hospital. The barber then told the stranger that there were always jobs there and referred him to the local state representative, Reeves Morgan, who McGehee thought could help the man. McGehee also told him that it might help to get a job at the hospital if he was a registered voter. He then directed this man to the county registrar of voters, Henry Palmer. After the assassination, Edwin Lee McGehee recognized Lee Harvey Oswald from TV as the same man who had come into his barbershop that day. The man who McGehee said was Oswald apparently took McGehee's advice about going to visit State Rep Reeves Morgan. Morgan told investigators from the House Select Committee on Assassinations that a man who introduced himself as Lee Oswald came to his house to ask about getting a job at the East Louisiana State Hospital in late August of 1963. Morgan told Oswald that he needed to take a civil service exam to get a job there, and that it would help Oswald to get the job if he was a registered voter. Morgan says that he met with Oswald for 20 to 25 minutes that day. He believed that Oswald had been driven to his home by someone because he heard the car drive up, but he didn't see it. According to Morgan's HSCA interview, his daughter Mary, who was home with him at the time, also did not see the car. However, when Mary was interviewed by author John Armstrong in 1994, she said that she was leaving the house when the car driving Oswald arrived. She is certain that the man she saw was Lee Harvey Oswald. Her brother, Van Morgan, told authors James DiEugenio and Bill Davey that when Oswald came to their house, he was playing outside when he saw a black Cadillac pull up. Van was about 10 years old at the time, but he did recall that the driver of the Cadillac had a shock of white hair. The fact that McGehee said that he gave Oswald a haircut and then referred him over to Reeves Morgan to help get a job, and then Reeves Morgan says that Oswald did in fact visit him to ask about this job, provides corroboration for McGehee's claim. But McGehee, Morgan, and Morgan's two children weren't the only ones who saw this black Cadillac. Clinton is a small Louisiana town that's about 15 miles east of Jackson, the place where Oswald allegedly got a haircut and visited Reeves Morgan. In the summer of 1963, much of the rural South was a hotbed of anti-black racism. Organizations like the Congress of Racial Equality, also known as CORE, were focused on securing the voting rights of black citizens by coordinating voter registration drives throughout the South. In late August of 1963, CORE was running a voter registration drive in Clinton. In the East Feliciana Parish, for which Clinton was the parish seat, only 1% of black residents were on the voter rolls as of 1962. This registration drive to help enfranchise all citizens in the parish was dangerous business, with constant threats of violence from the Ku Klux Klan and others. About a year after the Clinton voter registration drive, three volunteers associated with CORE, James Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, were abducted and murdered in rural Mississippi. The Gene Hackman film Mississippi Burning was loosely based on this incident. This voter registration drive in Clinton caused long lines of voters to stand outside in the August heat. Corey Collins was the chairman of CORE in Clinton and was outside observing the registration drive. Collins testified in the Clay Shaw trial that he noticed when there was a new black Cadillac that pulled up to the curb across the street from the voter registration office. He saw two men stay in the car and one man get out. About 3 months later, when Collins saw the photo of Lee Harvey Oswald on TV, he realized that Oswald was the man he had seen at the voter registration drive. Collins told the HSCA investigators, quote, "There weren't many strange cars in Clinton at the time, and when one would show up, everyone, white and black, would keep an eye on them. So when they drove up, I was outside and noticed them. Most of the people registering that day was black, and every now and then, a white would go in. So Lee Harvey Oswald was a stranger and was easy to spot." Henry Palmer was the voter registrar in Clinton. His office was open on Thursday, Friday, and Saturday mornings. Around 10:30 a.m. on a Thursday during a CORE voter registration drive, Palmer took a break and went across the street to go get coffee, passing the line of people waiting to register. Palmer noticed two white people standing in the long line of otherwise black people. Then Palmer noticed the new-looking black Cadillac, and he wanted to know more about who was in it, since there were not many cars that fancy in Clinton. So Palmer said that he asked the town marshal, John Manchester, to run a 1028 license plate check on the car and find out what this black Cadillac was doing in Clinton. After speaking with Palmer, Manchester then approached the Cadillac to get more information. He told the HSCA, quote, "I walked over and as I would, or any police officer would, I just checked the car out and I walked over and asked the driver, would he please identify himself? He gave me his driver's license and I looked at his driver's license and I asked him what his business was in town. He told me he was a representative of the International Trade Mart in New Orleans. The International Trade Mart is where Clay Shaw worked as the director." In Jim Garrison's case against Shaw, Manchester recited the same story and positively identified Clay Shaw as the man who was driving the black Cadillac. As a quick sidebar, Garrison claimed in his book, On the Trail of Assassins, that an actual license plate check was run on the vehicle and that the check came back to Jeff Bittison, who was a close associate of Clay Shaw at the International Trade Mart. If true, this would be a big deal because it would place that exact vehicle in Shaw's orbit. But I couldn't find any factual support for the idea that a vehicle license plate report, or a 1028, was ever actually run on the license plate of this black Cadillac by Manchester or anyone else. And since there's no proof of a license plate report being run, it is by no means established that this specific black Cadillac was linked to Bittison. It is true, however, that Clay Shaw's associate, Jeff Bittison, did own a new black Cadillac that matched the description of the ones that were seen by these witnesses. So we can't rule out that these witnesses saw Bittison's Cadillac. It's just not proven as a fact like it would be if a license plate check had been run. It looks like John Manchester took Henry Palmer's request for a 1028 as an informal request to get more information on the people in the car by talking to them, as opposed to actually running a license plate report on the vehicle. Either way, John Manchester did identify Clay Shaw as the man that he spoke with. We know that Manchester isn't just making this up because he was stationed in front of the voter registration drive that day, and Corey Collins saw him speaking to these two men inside of the black Cadillac. Collins' fellow Corps volunteer William Dunn was with him on the sidewalk, and both Collins and Dunn said that the two men in the Cadillac were Clay Shaw and David Ferry. When Henry Palmer testified at the Clay Shaw trial, he confirmed that Manchester told him that the men in the black Cadillac were representatives of the International Trade Mart. Palmer responded by asking Manchester, quote, what the International Trade Mart representatives were doing in Clinton. Since Palmer recalled that he was told by Manchester that the man driving the Cadillac was a representative of the International Trade Mart, that tends to corroborate Manchester's story. And that also shows that this isn't just a mistaken identity of one person who looks like someone else. What are the chances that a guy would happen to look like Clay Shaw and also would say that he was a representative of the International Trade Mart if that wasn't really Clay Shaw? And while Manchester didn't get a good look at the passenger, Henry Palmer did. Palmer said, quote, his eyebrows were heavy and his hair needed combing. He had messed up hair. I noticed that. That is all I could see of him. When Palmer was shown a photo of David Ferry, he said, quote, I can't recognize the individual, but the hair and the eyebrows are similar. As the registrar of voters, Henry Palmer interacted with many of the people who were trying to register that day. He positively identified Lee Harvey Oswald as being one of the two white men who were in line. When Oswald made it to the front of the line, Palmer asked him for his identification, and Oswald pulled out a Navy ID card. Palmer said, quote, "I looked at the name on it. It had Lee H. Oswald with a New Orleans address." Ultimately, Oswald wasn't able to register to vote because he couldn't prove that he lived in the parish for long enough. He then asked Palmer about getting a job at the Jackson Hospital, and Palmer told him that he did not need to be a registered voter to get a job there. After that, Oswald got up and left. After Jim Garrison reopened the case in 1967, his investigators Ann Dischler and Francis Frugier met with Palmer when he was still the registrar of voters. Palmer showed the investigators a book and said, quote, "Look, this is where Oswald registered." According to Dischler, although Oswald's name had been written over, you could still see the capital O, the space where Lee H. had been signed, and the shadow of his name. Palmer was coy about why the name had been written over, but later he admitted that he and John Manchester decided that they didn't want to say anything about Oswald being there. The next day, when the two investigators returned, the notebook was missing with no explanation.
Zaxby's Sensation Salad is so much more than a plain old salad. It's a salad, which begs the question, at what point does a salad stop being a salad and become a salad? Is it when you add Zaxby's fried chicken to it? Crunchy wontons? Asian slaw? Citrus vinaigrette? Teriyaki glaze? Sweet and spicy sauce? Or is it when you top it all with a handmade perfectly fried egg roll? Without a doubt, the egg roll. The Sensation Salad, only at Zaxby's.
So far, we have six people who say that they saw Oswald in connection with the Clinton-Jackson incident. Edwin McGehee, Reeves Morgan, Van Morgan, Mary Morgan, Henry Palmer, and Corey Collins. We also have the two Morgan children, John Manchester, Henry Palmer, Corey Collins, and William Dunn, who all say that they saw the black Cadillac. But they weren't the only ones. Local resident Charlotte Greenup said that the black Cadillac stayed there for hours. James Bell, a fellow Corps volunteer with William Dunn and Corey Collins, was asked how he so vividly remembered this black Cadillac. He responded, quote, "When you're working for Corps, you begin to try to read people and automobiles as fast as you can. And this makes sense in light of the constant threats of violence that Corps faced." Eddie Lee Spears also recalled the black car in Clinton with three white men sitting inside of it. Henry Clark, a local grocery clerk, recalls a very tall man who was walking down the street towards him wearing a dark business suit. As the man approached Clark, he turned to get into a black car that was parked at the curb. Clark also remembered that a man with unusual hair, which, quote, "stood up in all directions on his head," was making calls on the payphone that day. Henry Clark positively identified Clay Shaw as the tall man and David Ferry as the man with crazy hair. Around noon the next day, which is the third day of the trip overall if you're keeping track, Oswald apparently visited the East Louisiana State Hospital. Bobby Deedon saw Oswald in the hospital and gave him directions to the personnel office when he asked about where to go to fill out an employment application. She was interviewed by the HSCA in 1978, and when shown photos of Oswald, she said that the man she saw was very similar to the man in the photos, but had some differences. Specifically, she said, quote, "They favor and then they don't favor. This man has fuller lips and this man has a wire mouth. The haircuts are different. Their ears are the same." Maxine Kemp worked in the personnel office of the hospital. Kemp says that after the assassination of President Kennedy, she heard the name Lee Oswald on the radio, and then she checked the employment applicant files for the hospital for that name, Lee Oswald. She found a file titled Oswald, Lee. But by the time she was interviewed by Jim Garrison's investigators in 1967, that file had gone missing. Maxine Kemp isn't the only one who saw the Oswald file. It was also seen by hospital personnel director Aline Woodside. Assuming the witnesses are correct about what they saw, what was the point of this whole episode? Why would Oswald try to get a job at this hospital, which, by the way, was a mental institution? It wasn't near New Orleans, so what was going on? Jim Garrison concluded that the goal of the Jackson-Clinton operation was to get Oswald's name into the files at the hospital so that it could later be switched for a patient file, which would show that Oswald was mentally unstable if they wanted to play that card. But the part of the plan that Shaw and Ferry didn't think about, according to Garrison, was the massive voter registration drive that would make three out-of-town white guys in a fancy car very easy to notice and remember. We've reviewed the witness statements regarding Oswald, Shaw, Ferry, and the black Cadillac in Jackson and Clinton. But is it possible that all of those witnesses were either lying or mistaken? What are the counter-arguments about this saga from the Warren Report defender side? Well, there are a few. First of all, Oswald never missed a night at home except when he was in jail for one night in August, according to Marina. And Oswald would have had to be away from home for at least two nights per the timeline of this story, unless the men all drove back to New Orleans each night, which is possible. We don't know the details of whether this trip was overnight. It's also true that throughout the investigations in the JFK assassination, Marina Oswald's testimony is all over the place. So just because Marina says that something is true doesn't necessarily mean that it is. The second issue is the exact timing of the multi-day incident in question. There's not a precise date for when it happened. Edwin McGehee and Reeves Morgan both said that it was a cool day when Oswald visited. McGehee said the air conditioner was not on, and Morgan had a fire going in his fireplace. We know that Morgan was burning trash in the fireplace. He wasn't burning a fire to stay warm. But nevertheless, it's a fair point to say that we don't know the exact dates. A third potential weakness of the Warren Report critic argument is the inconsistent statements of witnesses. The witnesses didn't all say exactly the same thing. For example, Corey Collins told Garrison investigator Ann Deschler that he saw two men get out of the back of the black Cadillac, when others said that they only saw Oswald get out. The fourth counterpoint to the Clinton-Jackson witnesses is that Clay Shaw himself claimed that he was never in Clinton or Jackson during any of the relevant times. Shaw's boss, Lloyd Cobb, who owned the trademark, said that Shaw was in regular communication during this time, and he did not recall a three-day period when he was out of touch with Shaw. But their communications were not in person. They were over the phone. The fifth counterpoint is that John Manchester and Henry Palmer were both members of the local Ku Klux Klan at the time. The idea is that Palmer and Manchester had a bond and would be willing to lie on behalf of one another. Sure, the KKK was and is a terrible organization, but Manchester and Palmer's mere membership in the KKK doesn't mean that they were lying about what they saw, which, remember, was also corroborated by several black people and Corps volunteers. Also, if Manchester and Palmer are working together to mislead, what's their goal? What's the end game there? Finally, the sixth argument against the Jackson-Clinton witnesses is that they didn't come forward on their own after the assassination. Instead, they only spoke out after being contacted by investigators from Jim Garrison's office. But Edwin McGehee says that he contacted Reeves Morgan after the assassination to tell him that Oswald was the man that he had sent to him. And Morgan told McGehee that he had called the FBI and told them about this incident. So McGehee thought it was resolved. Morgan said that he did call the FBI in Baton Rouge about the matter, and that he was told that they already knew that Oswald had been in the area. That runs counter to what the FBI said in internal memos, which is that Morgan never contacted them. Reeves Morgan actually says the FBI called him back again to ask what clothes Oswald was wearing when Morgan saw him. Other witnesses who didn't speak to the FBI said that the reason they never came forward was that they thought the FBI would contact them, or they thought the matter had been resolved by the Warren Report. We just went over the arguments against the credibility of the witness statements that put Oswald traveling in a black Cadillac with Clay Shaw and David Ferry in Clinton and Jackson, Louisiana, in late August or early September of 1963. In total, we covered at least 10 witnesses who recalled seeing the black Cadillac, 7 witnesses who identified Lee Harvey Oswald, 4 witnesses who identified Clay Shaw, and 3 witnesses who identified David Ferry. When it comes to Oswald, there's the possibility that someone is impersonating him, which has continually popped up as we've studied this case. There's no explanation for Clay Shaw and David Ferry. The evidence showing Ferry was there is the weakest, while the evidence of Oswald and Clay Shaw being present is much stronger. The alleged Clinton-Jackson trip is a classic inference split point in this case. The real question is, what is more likely? That all of these witnesses were mistaken or lying, or that Clay Shaw was lying? What hammers it home for me and puts me firmly in the Warren Report critic camp on this issue is the consistency of the story about Oswald trying to get a job at the hospital. Oswald mentions his desire for a job at the East Hospital to the barber, McGehee, who then refers Oswald to State Rep Reeves Morgan, who also says Oswald was trying to get a job at the hospital. Morgan then told him that it would help him to get a job if he registered to vote. So Oswald then goes to see Henry Palmer, the registrar, who reports that Oswald's reason for registering was to try to get a job at the hospital. And on top of that, we have nurse aide Bobby Deedon, who gave directions to the hospital personnel office to someone who looked just like Oswald. We also have Maxine Kemp and Aline Woodside, who both said that they recalled seeing Lee Oswald's file at the hospital. The HSCA's conclusion about the Clinton-Jackson incident was, quote, "If the witnesses were not only truthful but accurate as well in their accounts, they established an association of an undetermined nature between Ferry, Shaw, and Oswald less than 3 months before the assassination. The committee was therefore inclined to believe that Oswald was in Clinton in late August, early September of 1963, and that he was in the company of David Ferry, if not Clay Shaw." Like the HSCA, I don't believe that the Clinton-Jackson witnesses made their stories up. I can't think of a plausible reason for all of these witnesses to do that. There are simply no incentives for the witnesses to lie. And if they did lie, that would mean someone would have to coordinate their stories together. We have no evidence for that. In my view, the most reasonable conclusion here is that Lee Harvey Oswald, or someone who looked like him and was trying to impersonate him, did in fact travel in a black Cadillac to Clinton and then Jackson with Clay Shaw and probably David Ferry in late August or early September of 1963. Next time on Solving JFK, we wrap up the remaining issues in New Orleans with a focus on David Ferry before turning our attention to Jim Garrison's trial against Clay Shaw. If you heard anything that you believe is out of context, or if you have additional information to offer, you can let us know at solvingjfkpodcast@gmail.com. Please provide citations to the record for any fact that you're relying on. For transcripts, sources, and official podcast merchandise, visit solvingjfkpodcast.com.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas.
The flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Thanks for listening. Visit solvingjfkpodcast.com for more information.
At Planet Fitness, we're declaring it. This is the year of getting stronger, and you can get started now by saving when you join today. We have all the best-in-class equipment you could ever need, and you can work out your way on your time at any convenient location near you, most open 24 hours. So let's do this. Join Planet Fitness today and save. Just $1 down, $15 a month. See Home Club for details.